Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello. Welcome to episode 30 of the Commentary Track, transcribed in Hollywood, or nearby Hollywood, and presented once again this week as a sustaining feature. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, the most sporadically working man in show business. Got a good one for you today. My friend Michael Mortilla. Michael is a prolific composer and musician, and I know him, or knew him, primarily as an accompanist to silent films. I frequently see him at Academy events, and he's at my favorite annual event, the A Century Ago program that Randy Haberkamp does at the Academy, which shows movies, as you might possibly guess, that were made 100 years ago. And this has been going on since, I believe, 2002, and I eagerly await it every year. And every year, Michael is the pianist, and he does yeoman work with all of these wonderful films, and it's always a pleasure to listen to him. And it's been a pleasure to get to know him. I called upon him to help out on my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, because I needed a little bit of additional music of a kind that I did not have on hand. And also, he turned out to be a great sound mixer, so he did some technical work for me, as well as doing some composing for me, and has also been a shoulder to cry on because, man, this has been a frustrating project. But it's almost over now, and boy, am I delighted, and it's looking good, and I think people are going to like it, and Michael will be a big part of that. So I always wanted to talk to him on the podcast about his career, and little did I know, because I'd never really talked with him in depth about his background, little did I know what an interesting career he's had, and that includes the Martha Graham Dance Company and being a conductor of orchestras before he could ever really read music very well, and all sorts of things, and then all this prolific work for all these silent films on DVD and Blu-ray and in live performance. And he's a really gifted musician and a great guy and a really interesting guy to talk to. And so I had a fun time over at his place. Been spending a lot of time over there during these working days on Lost Remake of Beaugest, but this time I came with a recorder in hand and got him to talk about his life. And I think you're going to dig it. At least I hope so. So enjoy the talk with Michael Mortilla, and I'll see you on the other side. I know that you studied music for a long time, and now you're scoring for films as at least part-time. So which came first, music?
Oh, movies? Music. Oh, music, for sure. That was in my family from the time even before I was born. My mother was a singer in church. So even when she was pregnant, I was in the womb listening to Bach and Schubert and Brahms, and how lucky, you know.
Wow.
And then I grew up singing in church choir when I was a little kid and going with my mother, who was a soprano soloist. And we had an old upright piano. My sister, before she sang with the Shangri-Las, which is kind of interesting.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Need to hear more about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, very interesting stuff. But she taught me a few things on piano when I was about 5 years old, maybe 4 years old. And I could play chopsticks and boogie woogie bass and heart and soul, usually the left hand, though.
Mm-hmm.
But I really had no interest in piano. And then I had a music teacher when I was seven. They finally said, well, maybe Michael should have piano lessons. And she had asthma. So the first 15 minutes of the half-hour lesson was devoted to my sister learning accordion. And the second half was me learning piano. So my sister would learn the accordion, and I'd hear the bellows of the accordion go, and then I'd hear the teacher go, and it scared the heck out of me as a little kid. So I, after a few lessons, I still have the book, actually. It's really funny to see my old music book when I was seven. But when the school, public school, decided that I was old enough to have lessons of an instrument, my instrument of choice was percussion because I was afraid that I would get asthma if I or emphysema from my teacher if I studied piano. So I went into drums and learned orchestral percussion from like the fourth grade up till graduation in high school. And I was a drummer that whole time.
Wow.
So then the transition to notes.
I mean, percussion of all kinds were you playing?
Or? Yeah, timpani, cymbals, bass drum, snare drum, triangle, Glock, a little bit of Glock, not so much because you had to read notes.
And sure.
None of us did, of the drummers. So that lasted probably till I graduated elementary school, and then in seventh grade we formed a band, and that was my first rock and roll band, and I was a drummer. And
I gotta know the name of the band.
The Long Island Sounds.
Ah.
Pretty good name.
I don't hate that name at all.
I probably three or four bands at least named that at the same time. But anyway, so I was a drummer, and then through that, I continued playing through high school. I continued as a percussionist in the orchestra and the band, but picked up rock and roll drums and got a drum set slowly, and got into heavier stuff like Led Zeppelin and Cream. And during that time, the organist in the band had a little Farfisa combo organ, which anybody from that period knows, the red and white organs.
Know it well.
And so occasionally he would teach me the beginning of Vanilla Fudge. What is that song? I'm blanking on the name of the song. Their big hit from the Vanilla Fudge album. Cher did a cover of it, too.
Oh, boy, I'm going to hate myself for not being able to come up with this.
Oh, we'll come up with it, but Keep Me Holding On.
Oh, okay. So that'd be free, why don't you, babe?
So there were three organ notes at the top, and he taught me that. So that was my reintroduction to keyboards. But I was really only interested in playing rock and roll songs. I didn't think anything about classical music or real music. And then I slowly picked up guitar from another band member eventually. And there were a couple of pivotal moments. So when I was 15, I went to the Woodstock Festival, which is a whole nother, we could do a whole podcast on the on my experience at the Woodstock.
Oh, and we will.
But that kind of made me realize, to some degree, what the artistic life could be. You know, rather than just seeing a band, it's like I saw people around me who, playing instruments and getting naked. And I thought, I could do this.
Sure.
So then I was on the road to being a rock and roller and a really, really bad student in high school because I cut all my classes for music classes. And then one of my friends was a pre-Juilliard student, and he's still a concert pianist, Stephen Glazer. And he was in the probably 11th grade, I guess it was, he did the Grieg Piano Concerto. And being a percussionist, I had the timpani part. And also having the timpani part means that when the concert's over, you have to hang around after everybody's gone and shove the timpani back onto the stage. So that was my job. So the audience cleared out, and I shoved the timpani under the stage. And here I am alone in this 600-seat auditorium with a beautiful Steinway grand piano. And being the cocky 16, 17-year-old that I was, I thought to myself, I could play as well as he could play. And I sat down and I started improvising. And sure enough, I could play not as well as he could play yet, but I could mimic that style. And it was almost like an idiot savant moment for me, where it's like, I didn't know I could improvise classical music. Wow, I can improvise classical music. Not knowing that that was, probably the one of the more unique skills that I had, and it's brought me up to being a full-time composer now since 1976.
Mm-hmm.
So
so you'd really never played the piano before that?
Other than when I was 5 years old, 4 years old, no.
Wow.
And that was like this wall comes tumbling down. They talk about, you see the wall come down when you're trying to understand something. That moment was when the wall came down for me. It's like, no, you're not a rock and roller. You this is really where the meat of your work is going to be. I didn't have that, profound revelation at that moment, but I did have a sense of the direction I then wanted to go in because I enjoyed it so much, and it was really unique. So then I started looking for piano teachers. At that point, we did not have a piano. We had sold our piano. So I started looking. The first place I looked is the place I knew where music was the church. And I was studying piano without a piano. So I would try to look at the score and make believe there was a keyboard under me, and that was the only way I could rehearse. But then, of course, I get to my lessons, and it's like I hadn't practiced. So it was all that was for naught. And at this point, I still couldn't read notes on a page. I could read rhythms, as a drummer, but I didn't, you know, if a note went up or down, I didn't know how far up or down it went. So I had to start that process, and I'm still working on that process to this day, you know, 40 years later. But the piano lessons were a disaster, to say the least. And then finally, I went to one teacher who was friends with a man named Arthur Levitt, who started Levittown. And his daughter was studying piano with my piano teacher and had outgrown her grand piano. So Mr. Levitt was looking for a student who needed the piano, and I was it. And from that point on, I've had a piano in my life. And it was, you know, it was a beat-up piano, and it needed work, and it needed strings and all this other stuff. But it was a free grand piano, and it was reasonably good. So at that point, I was able to start studying with a lot of other teachers, piano teachers, some pretty well-known people. Morton Estrin is a concert pianist, who some people might know, and then a couple of composers. But I was a terrible student. I didn't practice as much as I could. I still struggled reading music like it was foreign language that I'd never spoken before. So I just kept developing my improvisational skills so I could get my technique in shape. And I would learn slowly, you know, the Beethoven piano sonatas and, you know, some other, like Mozart, Haydn stuff. I would force myself to memorize, but I couldn't possibly sight read them. And I would miss notes like crazy, and the teachers would get infuriated with me, and I'd get infuriated with them. So I was on and off maybe three or four different teachers over a period of a year and a half was the total amount of lessons that I've had. But I would kept this improvisation thing going, and then I started getting involved in theater and then playing for theater, writing for theater. I still couldn't read the scores. I was doing musicals, but I was memorizing them. I was reading the chords, and I could play the melody. And what happened after that? I graduated high school, started to be a composer. That was in 72. Started trying to be a composer, but in the meantime needed to make some money. So I stamped numbers on phonograph needles. And for the Pickering Company in Point View, New York, and then worked as a landscape assistant for a while, and then landed a wonderful job at the Bell System when it was still a monopoly, and was one of the first male information operators in New York, and graduated to supervisor, and then the business center, and the taking orders from people on the phone, stuff like that. And they wanted me in their management program badly. And they were grooming me for that, although they never really put me in there. And I did that for about 3 years. But I was still playing music. And my first love was music. And sometimes I would go to work late. And they'd say, "Why were you late?" And I said, "I had a flat." and they knew exactly what I was saying. It's like, you mean A flat or A flat tire? Well, A flat, B flat, D flat, G flat. So I knew, you know, my time there was coming to an end. And one day I went to work. I might have been under the influence of an illegal substance at the time. I'm not sure. But I went to work and I just said, this is it. I'm not doing this anymore. And literally at 9 o'clock, I went in and I took my ID card, cut it in half, told the woman I worked with, it's been nice sitting next to you for the last couple of months and I'm not coming back. Goodbye. And I went out the door, and it put the system in shock. Because they didn't know how to deal with somebody who, you know, basically I died, according to them. And they kept trying to get me back, and I just wouldn't do it. And that was in, like, April of 1976. And I started looking for work as a composer and as a musician and have not stopped since.
Now, even when you were back with your rock band, did you ever write songs for them?
You know,
or were you all doing cover stuff?
We did cover stuff, and then I had a smaller two-piece of me and a friend of mine who I knew since I was 4 years old, who's still a professional musician, sax player, and I would play guitar and sing, and he would play flute and sing. He was in the Long Island Sounds as well. I mean, we went back, way back, and he's still a very close friend. But I would write songs, and sometimes we'd do them. And then I kind of got into my own solo act with my original music when I started writing songs. And I was very influenced by Jimi Hendrix And I had an electric guitar by that point, and I had a big old amplifier and another amplifier that I used as the preamp to make the fuzzbox sounds, which was really cool, except they kept blowing up. It was a little bit too hot for the for the main amp. So, but I did a solo act for a long time, and I would enter battles of the bands, and there were like six, seven guys in the other bands, and I'd go on there solo with a guitar. And I would do my own music, and sometimes I would throw in like the national anthem, Jimi Hendrix style. But mostly I was doing my own music and just basically writing rock songs at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And around 1974, I guess I started writing my first piano piece, official piano piece, through music theory in high school, because I did take music theory in, I don't know, 10th grade or something like that. So.
Wow. So you started looking for work, then how soon did you find any work?
Well, the first gig that I – well, I had some work. I was – when I graduated high school in 1972 – one of the reasons I didn't go to college is because in the fall of 72, 4 months, 5 months after I graduated, the drama, the guy who's the head of drama and a friend of mine, but he's an older guy, needed somebody to conduct Zorba the Greek. And the regular music director, who was my orchestra's teacher in high school, didn't want to do it because there weren't enough violin parts in it for him. So he said, I refuse to do it, and they kind of dug in and said, well, we're doing the show anyway, and he said, fine, go get another conductor. So they figured, well, Mortilla's got rhythm. He can beat a stick. I mean, that's all we really need, don't we? We just need somebody up there to wave his arms. So I was elected to wave my arms, and I think I got $15 for conducting that show for, like, 12 weeks work. A dollar a week isn't too bad, I guess.
That more was, than a dollar a week.
Yeah. Well, that was 74. 72? Yeah, 73, excuse me. 1973, that was. And, but in 76, after I quit, the first job that I had, let's see, I conducted the, by that point I was able to conduct, you know, after 2 years, because I had continued to conduct the high school for 6 years. Afterwards, so until 1978 or so, I was still conducting. And I was a faculty advisor for musical theater because I had all this experience and I was learning to read music. And I think to them, they were like developing a talent, which was nice. So I kind of I went from graduating high school to being a conductor, which is kind of an odd jump to make.
Yeah.
And a lot of people resented it. You know, friends that were in the orchestra before didn't want to be in the orchestra because they knew I wasn't like as adept at reading notes as they were. So they, you know, had a lot of people drop out.
Yeah.
And but eventually, through attrition, there were new musicians who came in. So I, you know, by 74, 75, I had great orchestras. And then, so I was doing that in the evenings while I was working for the phone company. And then in 76, when I quit the phone company, we did a production of 1776. And I was the music director and conductor for that as well. So that was probably my first job. And then in 1977 was probably my next job. I wrote a music. It was hard to write a musical for a company in Great Neck, Long Island. And that was a disaster. It was a really good group of people that were performing, but the people who wrote the score, and wrote the script and the lyrics and were producing the show were basically criminals and did make an attempt to steal my score and, you know, quote unquote, fired the composer when the initial run was done. And then it opened on Off-Broadway, excuse me. And it got a good, well, it got a terrible review, but the man who reviewed it, Leo Seligman, I think his name is Seligson, knew the backstory because do you want to hear all this?
I sure do.
Okay. The backstory on that is, so we did the show in October. They fired me after they used my score and my performance to raise money for the Off-Broadway production. They fired me and announced they were doing the Off-Broadway production, and this was all in Newsday on Long Island. So I wrote to Newsday, and I wrote to this guy, Leo Seligson, who wrote the initial article about, hey, this show is going to Broadway. And I said, well, you know, they raised that money with my score, and my score is not going to be there. So but they had said the initial run was somebody else's score. And I said, no, that was my score. So he issued the correction and was aware of the whole situation. So when it opened off of Broadway in New York, he panned it hard, the way I've never seen a show get panned. I mean, it was terrible. He said, with the exception of one song. On my birthday in 1978, I went to the St. Clements Theater and watched the show. And sure enough, one of the songs the band doesn't play, and they do one of my songs a cappella. So, because the new composer, didn't want anything to do with infringing my music. So he told the band members, don't play that song. So they improvised my song on stage a cappella, and that was enough to bring a federal lawsuit against them.
Wow.
And, eventually it settled because there was, I didn't have the resources to bring, and I was pro se for that. So it's like representing yourself in a federal lawsuit for copyright infringement, not the best idea I've come across. But eventually I did settle. The main reason I settled was because in between the time of that happening and the lawsuit starting to get to a point where it was going to go to trial, I landed a job with Martha Graham. And so I didn't really have time to, and I also didn't want to be involved in a lawsuit when I just started with a new company and it's a 26, 27 year old kid. I just wanted to do my work and let this go behind me. There wasn't really going to be a lot of money involved. And then there was a brief stint too. I'm giving you my whole life story here. There was another brief stint though between 77 and 79 when I worked for Graham, where I did land a job working for a mime troupe that did fashion shows in shopping malls, mostly in shopping malls. And my job was, one, I was the road manager because I had experience stage managing during that time as well. I did a little stint for Harry Chapin at PAF Playhouse. So I was the road manager for this mime troupe that did fashion shows. And my job, in addition to being road manager, was to dress up in a tuxedo and put white face on and sing Billy Joel songs in shopping centers while these guys did robots with fashions from the different stores. So I still can't walk into a shopping mall and not scout out the best place for the piano. It's got to be in front of one of the fashion stores or a jewelry store or something.
Well, I'm curious about the Martha Graham thing. Had you done theatrical stuff, but had you ever played for dance before this?
No, I hadn't. And what had happened is the theatrical stuff was not enough to keep me employed. And I was living on Long Island. I wasn't living in Manhattan. So, I was making $400, $500 a year at that point and living with my parents. And so one of my friends...
Except for the living with your parents, that's pretty much my life now. So continue.
So, let's see. Graham. Okay, so one of the guys who was a friend of mine during my rock and roll years, I'm still friends with on Facebook, by the way, and he's now like a professor of music, but he was like a harmonica player when I was a rocker. And he had I didn't even hear about him. I went to a piano concert with a friend and her piano teacher, and I was telling them, I improvise in classical styles. I can improvise almost anything. It's, what do? I don't want to play in bars. First of all, people don't want to hear you improvise in bars. They want to hear tunes. And so I said, what do? And they said, well, you should call Rob because Rob knows a little bit about improvisation. So in the meantime, I didn't realize that Rob became a killer pianist. And I called him I didn't realize it was the same Rob that I knew. And it's like, you're the same guy that used to play harmonica? And sure enough, it was him. And so we instantly had, our friendship was established long ago. And he said, if you improvise, the thing you need to do is send your resume to every dance studio in Manhattan. And they use improvising pianists all the time. Just send your resume. So I probably sent out 3 dozen resumes. And I had no resume to speak of in terms of dance. I had theater. It was a miserable resume. I still have copies of it I can show you. It was a terrible resume in terms of trying to land a dance position. So I sent this resume out and didn't get answers. I just got one answer, and that was from the Martha Graham studio. And they asked me to come in to watch a class. So I watched a class. And they said, do you think you could do that? And I said, sure, could do that. That's easy. So, and it would be. And I auditioned and played, and the teacher didn't even know I had never played dance before. She thought I had always, because I had, I mean, I played for theater. So you play for dance and you play for singers and you play for scene changes, but it's visual, a lot of visual stuff, like silent film. I mean, that's the connection for me for silent film is having worked in dance. That's why, you know, I never thought about playing for silent film until I got to Santa Barbara, and that was years and years and years after Graham and everything else. So that's how I landed the Graham job, though.
So you worked for, you played for dance companies a lot after that, right?
Yeah, after, well, because it's a very small community. I mean, it's a tight, I shouldn't say small, but it's a tight community. So if you play for Graham, some of the teachers and students at the Graham are teaching at Ailey. So they'll say, I'm doing a class at Ailey. Would you come and play for my Graham class at Ailey? And then somebody at Ailey hears you and says, you know, you'd be really good in Horton technique and blah, 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 blah. And then somebody once made the mistake of saying, you'd be really good in ballet technique. And so I went to ballet, and I tried to play ballet the same way I play modern, and disaster time. Oh, my God, the worst. Now I've gotten better. I can play a ballet class like nobody's business, but it was very different. So I was kind of limited to modern classes and then some tap classes because I could play jazz. So I was working doing tap dance stuff. And I had applied to colleges, including Juilliard, when I was thinking I wanted to be a composer. Of course, they all rejected me, except for Berkeley and Boston. You've heard of that one.
I think I've heard of it.
But Juilliard, you know.
They've never heard of me, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, really. I still have my Juilliard rejection letter. and rereading it recently, I agree with everything they said, because I looked at the submission, and now that I'm, you know, been a composer for 40 years, I looked at it and said, of course they were right. I needed a few years of counterpoint. But they rejected me. So then when I went into doing dance, I took very great pride in my first check from Juilliard, because they had hired me as a musician, as a professional musician.
Nice.
But I was not good enough to study there, just to work there. And I probably wouldn't have been rejected at UC Santa Barbara, and I taught music there for 14 years.
Wow.
But I probably couldn't get in as a musician.
Yeah.
To this day, I probably still couldn't get in. They'll have to give me an honorary.
Well, how did it come about that you started playing for silent films?
I was teaching at UC Santa Barbara, and anyone who knows Santa Barbara knows that teaching as half staff, half teaching, wasn't enough of a salary to live there. So I had to supplement my income. And so I supplemented my income by tuning pianos, which I learned to do in New York, also to supplement my income. So like at the Leo Graham Studio, I would be paid during the week to put the pianos out of tune and break them. And then over the weekends, I'd actually make 2 to 3 times more money than I made playing the pianos, fixing and tuning them. So I loved it. It was a win-win for me.
Sure.
So I was tuning pianos in Santa Barbara, and this little old lady had called me because I placed an ad in the newspaper. And she had this old upright piano, and she had put, you know, these lavalier doors on the back of it so it would look nice in her living room, and it was horrible upright. It was just terrible. And I almost walked out on that gig. It's like, I don't know if I really want to tune this piano. So, but I did, because she was a nice lady. And when I was done, I was playing some of my own pieces, a ragtime piece that I had written that I usually play when I finish tuning to just test the tuning. So she heard that, and she says, oh, that's lovely. Is that yours? Yes, it's, yeah, I really like that. And she said, do you have a card? And I gave her my card. She said, well, I'm friends with the woman who's the executive director at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. And I don't know, maybe they could use somebody with your skills. So I gave her my card, and a couple of weeks later I heard back that they were doing a silent film, their first silent film, tribute to the Flying A Studio. And they were bringing, I think it was The Ghost of Rosie Taylor was the movie from the Flying A. And Bob Burchard brought the film up from Los Angeles for them to project. And I think he was introducing the film and projecting. And I had never seen a silent film if it wasn't on PBS. I had no... Well, that's true. I'd seen some in my lofts because I had a loft in Manhattan. And there's a whole other story there. But so Burchard showed this film and brought Randy Haverkamp with him. And Randy was working at CBS at the time. And Randy heard... I can't imagine why Randy liked anything that I played because it was my first silent film for one. So I had no idea what I was going to play. But to make matters worse... I had never played in a silent film, so I did not realize that when the lights go out, the lights go out. And this was just pitch dark. So I was literally playing by touch. And it's not something I'm used to doing. I could do it if I have to, but it's duress. But Randy heard something that he liked and said, you know, give me your card and maybe we can, you know, if we do a screening in Los Angeles, we can use you. And so I started playing at the Barn, and they had just formed the Silent Society with David Shepherd. And I started doing their screenings, and that's how I ended up in the loop, as it were. The loop which has now surrounded my life many times over.
Well, since this is not something that you had never done before, did you just step right into it? I mean, were there any challenges that you didn't expect about accompanying the silent films?
Well, the first challenge was I never got to see the film ahead of time. There weren't really... keeping up the chase scenes was the first thing that you don't realize how much craft goes into that. You know, playing background music for romantic sections is pretty easy. You can play languid music and you get away with it. And the chase scenes have to be... the energy has to be high. But you can't have it be incessant. You have to find breathing places, and you have to find places where you can give people's ear a break. And that's something, again, I'm struggling with that. I spent the last 2 days struggling with that with another film. So that was probably the biggest challenge for me to overtake is the repetitiveness. Mm-hmm. And finding stylistic variation to keep the score interesting. At first, I didn't know what I was doing at all. I was just going by the seat of my pants. It took me about, I would say, a year, maybe a year and a half before I started really listening to what I was doing as opposed to just worrying about getting the notes out. Mm. So that was the difference.
So you'd never really listened to any other composers who had written for silent films?
No. No.
To see how anybody else was doing
it? I had no idea how they were doing it. I'd seen some Buster Keaton stuff on PBS, and I couldn't remember. It was probably... something out of Britain, I guess, but I had no idea how the style. It was like playing ballet class, you know. Until you know what the style is they're looking for, you can't help replicate it. And to this day, I probably don't replicate the silent films, general silent film scores, because when I play piano solo, I still improvise. Even if I have a score for the film, I'll improvise. So it's just me. It's, you know, my stream of consciousness.
Now, did it ever get to a point where silent film composing and playing was your major thrust? I mean, is that the case now?
No. My major thrust has always been as a legitimate composer, serious composer. And if silent film works into that, great. But I'm still, I do a lot of stuff. I mean, I've written tons of... for over 1,000 pieces, and most of them are not silent film pieces. Most of them are theater and dance pieces. So even with silent film, I mean, if it weren't for silent film, I wouldn't have had pieces on the Chicago Symphony or at the Olympics or, you know, a couple of these other orchestras. Or, so it's been a vehicle, but it hasn't been the main... the main thrust of my career to me is making the best music I can make, and right now a lot of it is silent film music. But I'm also in the middle of doing a dance piece and help somebody with a theater piece. So I, you know, I do a lot of different stuff, and the, you know, given my own device, left to my own devices, I should say, I'd be writing probably serious classical music that nobody would listen to.
I'm not quite sure how that world works anyway. I mean, how it seems to me that the classical repertory is pretty much limited to the dead guys, and that the chances of getting a new piece from a living composer seems to be a very narrow hallway, isn't it?
I mean, it is. It's very narrow. And it's a lot of who you know, which is anywhere. You know. So it's nice to have that, again, to have the silent film vehicle to do that. But I've also done, like I've scored stuff, evenings for Patton Oswalt. I did four evenings for him with a script that he reads called, what was it called? The Day the Clown Cried, the Jerry Lewis film from the early 60s, I think. And so he, you know, that's a theatrical kind of thing. And so that kind of put me in with, you know, some of the people at Comedy Central and the Conan O'Brien writers and stand-up comedians and David Cross and, you know, those kinds of guys.
So to go back a second,
yeah,
does Patton Oswalt simply read the script of The Day the Clown Cried?
Well, he has a cast.
Oh, they act out the entire script?
It's a reading, and they're free to...
Because I want to attend one of those.
I don't know if he's doing them anymore.
For people who don't know, The Day the Clown Cried is a film that Jerry Lewis made about a clown in a concentration camp, a Jewish clown in a concentration camp. And the very few people who have ever seen it, Harry Shearer wrote a famous piece about seeing a bootleg video of it at one point. And it's apparently just appalling.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read the script, and the script is jaw-droppingly unbelievable.
Yeah.
So did you just improvise music?
Yeah,
for
he just
that?
Said, go do what you want. Because these are all stand-up guys. I mean, you have people like Rob Corddry and Fred Arneson. And, I mean, those are the people that we had doing this. Fred Willard, depending on if you're doing it in L.A. or New York. But it was like the who's who's list of stand-up comedians. And, you know, really the top-notch, amazing performers. So he knows, you know, you just let them go. Let them do what they're going to do. So in some cases it got a little out of control, very funny, definitely adult. and he just had me play whatever I felt like playing. But interestingly enough, Patton Oswalt knew who I was, first of all, through the silent movie theater, because I used to play there. So he went to the silent movie theater and saw me one day and introduced himself. And I didn't think anything of it because I hadn't heard of him and never heard of him again. And then I was doing a theater piece for a guy who I knew in high school. This is just a couple of years ago, though, because we're still friends. Ron Lynch, who you may not have heard of, but he's a stand-up comedian and he does...
I have heard of him, yeah.
He does a show every Saturday night at midnight at the Steve Allen Theater. And he's hysterically funny. He's been doing a lot of TV stuff and voiceovers. And so I was doing a show with Ron Lynch, and one of the music directors, who's a friend of his, came to watch our show. And he had been asked to do The Day the Clown Cried and declined to do it because he was too busy. So he asked me if I'd be interested and, you know, could I give my number to these guys. And they remembered me from the silent movie theater, and they liked what I did. And they said, sure, no, he can improvise. Yeah, he'd be great for stand-up. So that's how I ended up doing the Patton Oswalt thing.
Wow.
That's all silent film again, you know?
It all comes back to the silence.
It does.
Well,
it does.
Now that you've become a part of that world, the silent film world, has it led you to do, I mean, do you really watch a lot of silent film now? Or, I mean, more than you... would have? Is it something that's now in your in your arsenal?
Nope. You know, I've as a composer, I don't even listen to music, you know, because there's always something going on in my brain. And, you know, I will occasionally attend a silent film screening, a live screening. It's really rare because I go crazy. There's very few silent musicians I can tolerate. I can count them on three fingers, and I'm one of them.
Well, by and large, what do you think, if you can't tolerate what they're doing, what do you think it is that you're objecting to?
It's a variety of things. Sometimes it's lazy performances or inept performances. Other times it's what I consider inappropriate selections of music. Other times it's lazy composing, where they actually take the time to compose, but they don't really think about what they're doing. And they just repeat the same thing over and 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 over. I mean, I got to the point where some performances I can go to and count the number of repetitions. You know, how many times are they taking the double bar and repeating back? And, you know, when you get to like 14 or 15, you just say, you know, it's wallpaper. And for me, I love silent films passionately, but I want to see them represented in a way with integrity. And so, you know, even some of the commercial discs that I have, if I'm interested to see what the film is, I'll turn off the music. It's very, very rare that I watch a film, even if I have a screener and it has music on it, I'll never listen to the music that's on the screener because I don't want to be influenced.
Sure.
I want to develop my own voice for it. And people don't always agree, you know, with what my voice is. You know, I've had scores rejected two this week that I have to redo. But that's okay because I'm prolific and you know, it'll take me an extra day and a half to do the extra two scores. But they'll be better scores because I already have the critic's decision on my score, in a sense. That's one way to look at it.
Sure.
And that's, you know, what producers, it's rare that you have producers of silent films who actually make decisions and say, yeah, this scene works, this scene doesn't work. But when you have that, it's great because it's like you want to find out before the audience sees it if it sucks.
Sure.
And it may not suck to you. And to me, I don't think it sucks. But if I'm dragging the film down and I don't realize it, I want to know, you know. So so I kind of thrive on that. But in terms of watching films, it's really hard for me to listen to other people's music to silent films. And maybe that's just my ego talking. I don't know.
No, I think it's more than that because I don't accompany silent films, and I have a real hard time listening to the great majority of at least when I get something on DVD or Blu-ray, the chances are at least 50-50 that I'm going to hate the music that's on there. Mm-hmm. And what it mostly is for me is that too many composers use the film as a background to their music.
Absolutely.
And that, to me, is the number one sin. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a couple that it just drive me crazy.
Yeah, Beyond the Rocks.
Oh, yeah, horrible.
We're not going to name the composer because we don't want to perpetuate it.
I'm not going to be libeling anybody because I can't remember the name of the film, much less the name of the composer. But people will be able to infer what I'm talking about. It was a Mary Pickford film, and it wasn't one that I was familiar with at all, but it seemed to me it was basically a serious film, as I remember. Because all I remember is this one section. But there's a segment in it. She's like a peasant girl, a farm girl. And there's a segment where a priest comes to their little farmhouse and is invited to dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what this film is?
I do, and I don't remember the name.
And while he's praying this intolerably long blessing for the meal, a chicken gets loose, and Mary is chasing it all over the room and then outside and everything. Clearly, a lighthearted comic little sequence.
Unless you're the chicken.
Unless you're the chicken. Well, the chicken's not even for dinner. It's just a chicken. It's future dinner. But the music is going, you know, she's chasing the chicken around. The music is going, yada,
no.
You're going, what the? It's just unbelievable that somebody could look at that image and that's the music that came to their mind.
Yeah, well, there is notably one silent film composer who she will not go named, but who takes pride in the fact that she doesn't even watch the films. She gets the length of the film and she writes a piece of music for the length of the piece of the film, and that's it. She's done. And she gets the top bucks for doing it.
And does she have incredibly gifted relatives?
She does. Yes. She does.
In fact, one of her relatives is the single greatest of all film composers, I would say.
It could be. Could be that same one.
Yeah.
Albert Einstein?
Albert Einstein.
No, close, though.
It's just... Yeah. I don't understand it. But I've seen it in so many cases where I'll go. I mean, there are lots that have sort of jazz tinged, and I love jazz. I went to Berklee College of Music. I'd studied jazz.
I've heard of that.
But if it's inappropriate to the film, it's not good music. That's just. Or I mean, it might be good music if you just listen to it on your headphones.
Yeah. Well, you're coming from a place, you know, and we both, I think, come from a place of integrity in terms of the films, and for me also in terms of my music, because it's an insult to the music to put the music in the wrong space.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, but you know, you also have to remember that a lot of the generation that they're trying to appeal to are the people who also don't have any qualms about stealing music off the internet and not paying, you know, composers or writers for their work. So I think that that's partially it. And I know people, a friend of mine who I will mention because I like him, Kevin Hayes, did a thing with The Hunchback of Notre Dame, with clips of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and the Lon Chaney version. And he pulls no qualms. He wrote an opera about The Hunchback of Notre Dame. He's got people on stage and really wonderful singers, and it's a wonderful score. But it's got nothing to do with the silent film era. But he goes lock, stock, and barrel into presenting this, and then it's a backdrop behind it, and it's very effective. And I don't think it's demeaning to the film at all.
I accept that because it's not, because the film is being used as an element
exactly.
in something else.
Exactly, yeah. But the bang on a can crap, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't like it. And I know I'm not alone. And, you know, they don't pull any qualms about it. The guys who do that kind of stuff say, yeah, the films are a vehicle for our music. We're only interested in making money.
And a lot of times, we'll get into the argument about some of these scores that they're what we used to call 20th century music.
Right.
Atonal sort of things. And that's not what I object to at all, because I love that music.
Yeah.
Charles Ives, probably my favorite composer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a workshop with Karlheinz Stockhausen one time, and it was an incredible experience.
I'm sure. Wow.
And, you know, so I love that. I love Webern. I love, you know, Ligeti, all these people. This is music that means a lot to me.
Yeah.
But it does not work with Sherlock Jr., you know?
No,
it just doesn't.
Funny you should pick that one.
Oh, well, that score on that DVD...
Yeah.
I almost threw that disc out the window the first time I ever heard that.
And well, I'll keep the disc and shut the sound. But
yeah,
I don't really get that. And I've always come from a place where, for my theatrical training in particular, you have to be loyal to the period you're working in.
Yeah.
So if you're writing, you know, if I'm writing a piece that's supposed to be taking place in, I don't know, 1850s England. I'm going to research the music, and I'm not going to use music past 1850 England. And I do the same thing with silent films. I look at the date of the film. I did it last night. And it's if the film takes place in 1920, I'm not going to write music that is was developed after 1920. I won't use songs at all. And it's very rare. That's not true. I just used three folk songs, but they were public domain.
Yeah.
But I won't generally even use songs because there's always that connotation of what they mean. But in terms of the period, I don't think you should go much further. And I think you can make some – I think there's a lot of wiggle room there. Like you could do Metropolis and you could have something like the Rite of Spring kind of sounding score.
Sure.
And that – I mean, it's a little over the top, but then again, so is Metropolis for that matter.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Rite of Spring premiered what, 1916?
1912,
okay. So I think that stylistically is fair game. And I don't think Stravinsky would have been writing for silent film, but he was writing for Diaghilev. So, you know, he was writing for the, you know, the lively
arts. Writing for theater, and that's only a step away from...
Exactly,
yeah.
And they just didn't realize, you know, they could do that. Well, some people did realize they could do that kind of stuff on film. But, it took years to get the craft developed.
Yeah, it did take a while before... I guess, in many ways, we don't really know.
Melies was doing weird
stuff. Yeah, what people were doing, you know, I mean, who knows.
But it was still, even Melies, you know, is archaic by later standards, and you know, something like Sunrise. You know.
Sure.
So.
But But also, the Méliès films are a little bit outside of time, too. I mean, there's something, because they deal with futuristic subjects sometimes. And
he was a magician.
And they're fantastical films. So there's actually, to me, a lot more leeway about the kinds of music that would be appropriate for a film like that. But there's still a very simple equation, and that is, does it enhance the film? Does it support the film?
Yeah.
Are the emotions that are supposed to be in the film supported and brought out? And if they're not, then the music's wrong. That's just all there is to it.
Yeah. Well, that's not quite a gimmick, but I mean, I'm always cognizant of perspectives when I'm writing, especially for film and theater. And in film in particular, I always think, you know, whose perspective am I writing this from? And I do this a lot in silent films, and this is what gets me into trouble with producers sometimes. I'll look at the film, and I'll pick a character, usually the main character, and I'll say, okay, I'm going to be writing it from this person's perspective. Well, if it's Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin, they're actually tragic characters.
Yeah.
And there's a lot happening to them that's bad. So I don't, you know, when the guy's getting beat on, when poor Buster's, you know, they're trying to kill him with a pool cue or, you know, whatever, I don't necessarily always find humor in it. And the audiences, you know, some of the producer people think, oh, no, it's a comedy. You got to make it a comedy. You got to punch it up as a comedy. And I don't agree with that 100%. I really don't. Because I've played it that way for audiences, and they respond. Yeah. And I think there's you can correct me because you know silent film better than me, but it seems to me there's almost the inherent setup by the writing and the performing when you have somebody like Keaton, and he's the underdog the whole time, and then he gets the girl in the end. Or maybe not. You know, in Cops, he doesn't get the girl.
Sure.
He has to go back into the police station and get arrested. Which is also tragic. There's enough funny there that you don't need to be too tragic with him.
And he dies at the end of quite a few of his films, too.
But I think there is the natural setup that, you know, you want the hero to win. You want him to experience one. And, you know, what do? Do you put in the slapstick stuff when he's getting beat on? Or do you go from his perspective? Or do you just go from this third-party disconnect of the audience? You know, what do you want the audience to be doing? Well, we want the audience to be having a good time and laughing. So let's, you know, it's like Jerry Lewis. Let's punch up when they guess these kids. You know, and that's basically what he did. You know, it's...
Yeah. I generally find that comedy is almost never really enhanced by funny music.
Yeah.
And I say funny in air quotes.
Right.
And I can't think of many examples in which it really does work. One of the things that I revere Laurel and Hardy. I think they're at the very top of the peak. And I think one of the things that's wonderful about most of their shorts is that they just have this carpet of music. And the music will change to a certain degree, but it's this... It's just the Leroy Shields and those... And it doesn't, sometimes it'll specifically address something that's happening.
Yeah.
But mostly it just lets them be funny, and the music is this there to be a background to
it.
And then when you get to the Laurel and Hardy films at Fox, say, the feature films, which are generally not very funny, the music is constantly trying to make them funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And, you go right through all the great comics in sound, and you very rarely find funny-sounding music because it just doesn't work that much.
Yeah. Well, one of the greatest comedic filmmakers we've ever experienced in our lifetimes is Mel Brooks.
Sure.
And look at what he did in Young Frankenstein musically. There was no happy, funny, ha-ha music.
No.
But it was a knee slapper. You know.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's
that text. Is serious, beautiful music in Young Frankenstein.
Yeah,
that would support a serious film of that same subject.
Yeah, and even Blazing Saddles. There's no ha ha left.
No
funny stuff. But I don't think it really needs it. But then again, I'm not the perfect person selling the soap, And it gets down to, you know, selling your product. And unfortunately, a lot of people who are the buyers for this stuff, I'm gonna try to cushion this. They're a little bit more shallow in their in their standards of what they will accept.
Shallow works, yeah.
Whereas, you know, you and I and the other, you know, serious folks that we know tend to look for a little bit more from the experience. We want to saturate ourselves with the total experience, not just, oh, well, there's a film and there's music. We want those things to connect, you know.
Well, I think in my case, I came up at a time when silent films, if they were shown on TV at all, were shown in an attitude of ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were given really wacky music or the bad Hearts and Flowers kind of, you know, tinkly piano sort of things. And they were made to look as absurd as possible. And I think for some, I think I've lived my entire life being sensitive to that.
Yeah.
And being annoyed by it and wanting to make sure that these films are taken seriously. And that means, I mean, even when I'm talking about the comedies, I want them taken seriously. I want them taken on their mm-hmm. own terms, because the best of these films are the best of films that were ever made.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do us any good. People are always talking about building new audiences and, oh, the kids who are watching today don't blah, blah, blah. But you're only going to build a new audience if you give it the best showcase.
Yeah.
And show how beautiful they are and how good they should look
yeah.
and how good they should sound. Yeah. And that's something that is, I'm always really sensitive to. And when I see somebody pandering to it, it bothers me.
Yeah. And there's two things I can talk about there. One, as far as the new audience goes, I bring silent films to elementary schools all the time. And you see these five-year-old kids, six-year-old kids in kindergarten, first grade, watching a film that's 85 years old and laughing hysterically.
Sure.
So the new audience, I think...
As they should.
Yeah. I think the new audience is there if you just give it to them.
Yeah.
I think they'll accept that. And I think people eventually are going to start moving away from the convenience of electronics and start looking for some meaning in life.
Because, let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope.
But I was... You know, who am I to give anybody advice? But every time a friend of mine has a new child, I always say, make sure you show them lots of black and white stuff early in their childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're used to it. So that it's not a, because people for some reason act like children are now coming out of the womb with short attention spans
mm-hmm.
and with a hatred for black and white. Well, they're not.
No,
they're coming out as babies and.
Yeah.
They will learn to like what is good if you show it to them.
Yeah. The other thing, in regard to what you were saying, in terms of the integrity of the music connecting to the story, I think it's a different, you know, ultimately, any art form for me is about storytelling. There's a story, and if there's not a story, it's probably a bad piece of art, because mm-hmm. it's not conveying something to you. And maybe you don't know what the story is. Or as Morton Subotnick once said, you know, I know my music. I don't know what my music means. I only know it's meaningful.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing. And when you juxtapose something that doesn't fit, at best, you're story saying. You're not storytelling. And, you know, just reciting words, you know. And then you don't really care if Romeo and Juliet get together in the end. And it doesn't really affect you in the end when she dies.
Yeah.
Because you're not really setting the audience up emotionally for that. And I think that's the greatest loss with inappropriate, I'll call it inappropriate music, which is a big phrase and not everybody will agree. But I think what you lose is if there's a humanity in the story in particular, you're going to lose that because the music is not going to send the right signal mm-hmm. as to what is this story about. This story is not about... how loud my cymbal can be clashed in the absolutely wrong place. You know, it's about stories and good storytelling and good art. And I hate to say it, but a lot of that stuff ain't art.
No. Now, is it just a coincidence that I seem to see your name attached primarily to early films. I mean, I guess it's also because I'm so used to seeing you at the Century Ago program at the Academy,
yeah.
which is my favorite annual program. And you're always there and you're always great. But, you know, when I was over here the other day, you were showing me stuff that you were doing. And it all tended to be teens, early stuff. Is that primarily what you seem to work on, or is it just coincidence, or what?
No, I think it's just coincidence. I mean, when you say early stuff, you're talking about stuff that's not in the late 20s.
Yeah.
No, but I've also...
I'm talking about pre-1916, say.
Yeah. Well, the first project I did was Chaplin, which was 16, 17, 18, so that was still pretty early.
Yeah.
But I've also scored Humoresque, which was a later one, and Seventh Heaven.
Oh, yeah.
And The Gaucho. I have done some older films. I think, but there is a point to what you're saying, and I know what it is.
I wish I did.
Well, I do. I'll enlighten you.
Okay.
I think the reason that happens is because I've aligned myself and been very fortunate to be aligned with a couple of the major archives, National Film Preservation Foundation. And the Academy of Motion Pictures. And when they do either a restoration or a screening, they often pick stuff that people aren't going to see normally. So that, I think because I'm working more with archives as opposed to commercial releases, that's why you're seeing that.
Yeah. And you provided the music to the film that my wife and I funded the restoration of. Mm-hmm. Billy and His Pal.
Yeah, which is
great. So you and I are linked artistically forever.
Well, that's a good thing for me.
Oh, and also in Lost Remake of Beaugest, where
we'll
be linked forever in that as well.
So. Yeah.
But, yeah, it's just that happens to be my favorite period of movie history, I think. The Nickelodeon era. I love the often rural feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the beginnings of things, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's always... I love early sound era, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I love when things are getting started and seeing how people are working things out.
Yeah.
And it's always fascinating to me. And whenever... Because especially when you're looking at films from 1908 to 1912, people are really creative in that period of time. I mean, that's... It's like unchecked creativity.
Yeah.
They're really thinking of stuff, and they're trying everything. And it's just exciting to watch it growing and being birthed, you know?
Yeah. And even with it, I get even more so from that period than I do from the earlier Méliès stuff. I'm very cognizant of the fact that these are the first recorded moving images of civilization.
Yeah.
At least that we know of. And that always fascinates me because I'm always looking. You know, I'm looking into the corners of buildings. I'm looking in the reflections of glass.
Oh, me too. Always.
You know, we watch films in a very different way. I think when you really saturated with this, I was watching one the other day. It's like I noticed I had seen the film probably 50 times while I scored it, and then I'm going through the score, check for wrong notes and stuff like that, and I'm noticing reflections in the glass. And it's like sometimes you can see in the Chaplin Mutuals, there's a place where you can see the cameraman. In the reflection of one of the store windows.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that that I love. It's like, yeah, that's a mistake, but that's one of the more interesting things in the film because I can see the cameraman.
And I've talked about this before on this podcast, but it's my podcast, so I'll talk about it again. One of the wonderful things about film is that it's capturing a documentary image of its time and place, whether it even means to or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have Buster Keaton running down Hollywood Boulevard or down Cahuenga in 1920,
right.
You're seeing a funny gag and you're seeing a great constructed film, but what you're also seeing is the real place of that time.
Yeah.
John Bengtson, whose books I just adore, he just posted on his website recently, because the Blu-ray is making these discoveries more and more possible all the time, he found that, you know, in Cops, when the anarchist throws the bomb off, and it lands in Buster's lap on the wagon.
So he lights his cigarette off.
Yeah, and that anarchist is on top of Musso and Frank.
Oh, you're kidding.
And in the background, you can see the Egyptian being built.
Oh, wow.
Right across the street, and it's only for that one shot. And
oh,
you have to freeze frame to look at it. But there it is. And for, I mean, that's the sort of thing that John would find, because he's got that eye, and I do not have it in any way. But now that I've seen that, you just think, that's just magic. I mean, that's, I get miffed at people who don't like silent films or talk about films, call them dated or whatever.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, we're the first people in the history of the universe who can look at our world in motion from 120 years ago.
Oh, I don't know about in the universe. I have a
well, maybe, yeah.
On this planet.
On this planet. Yes.
I won't speak for what's going on under the clouds of Saturn.
I will, because I've looked into it. But I'm not at liberty to go into it any farther than that. But it's magical.
It is.
It's a miracle.
It is. It truly is.
And it's, you know, you look at some of these films that still exist from 1895 or 1896, and there are those people, and there, I mean, you know, when I was up talking with David Keene up at the Niles a few weeks ago, we were talking about that Trip Down Market Street film.
Yeah.
That
Before and After the Quake.
Yeah. That he's the one who pegged when it was shot. But even before you know that, that film is a magical experience.
Oh, yeah.
Just looking at all these cars and all, I mean, the people, and they're not doing anything but just living their lives. But that's 108 years ago, and we can look at it.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible.
Yeah.
So I get really up on my high horse about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's probably why I connect you with those films, because you've done so many scores for those things.
Yeah.
But it's also because it's a period that I love so much, and your music is music that I love so much.
Okay.
So I'm happy to link you up together
in a
happy place for me.
Yeah, you know? I agree with you that that's a lot of what I've done in terms of the silent film world. I also have another side to me musically, so I don't want you to think of.
I did
work for Martha. You know,
I'm not trying to pigeonhole you. Yeah. That's what. No. But this is a film podcast, so you know that's what.
No, I embrace all that all those concepts that you're talking about. I do love myself. In fact, one of the other ones I did that you saw, I believe, is the Harry Houdini Master Mysteries.
Yes,
and that's a little bit later, but still pretty archaic.
And
still very much. Look, this, I don't know where it was shot, but Chicago or New York or what, but, you know, it's a recording, it's a slice of time that we can pick up and look at.
Yeah. And those films we were watching the other day from that you're scoring now, that Pathé colored one from the Tennessee Hills and that South Seas one,
Love
Triangle. That was shot in two color, Technicolor. You know, there was nothing to the story of that film. I mean, it wasn't that compelling as what it meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it a miracle is what it didn't mean to be, which is just the people of the time and the landscape and all of that stuff. And there it is, and it's in color.
Yeah. Well, the one I'm working on this last 2 days, and I'm actually rewriting this is my fourth score for it, I believe, maybe the fifth. But the making of a hat, and so last night was another revelation for me. I'm doing the making of the hat, and I'm starting to notice how much felt is in the air. It's like it's snowing in that place, but you don't, you know, when you first look at the film, and it's like, yeah, there's a man, he's making a hat, and then you start looking at the light of the felt that's being reflected, and you realize not only is he making a hat, but he's breathing all this stuff in. Nobody's got any kind of protective stuff on, and how many people, you know, had lung felt disease? I don't know what you call that, but
yeah,
there's got to be, you know, there's chemicals on the felt and everything else, and you start to realize, and that's what I was, when I first did the film, This is why I'm doing my fourth score for it. When I first did the film, my emphasis was the people in the factory. It wasn't the activity, it was the people in the factory. And that's totally the wrong way to go in a film like that, because it's kind of a documentary, and yeah, it's the busyness of what's going on, and it's an advertisement for hats. So, you know, you have, again, you have to sell soap. So in that case, I don't go with my gut, which is to try to tell the story of these people, and you can't really tell the story of all those people. So, you know, I went in a different direction, and it works, too.
Yeah.
But my instinct is, yeah, this woman is working probably 14 hours a day, and she's coming home with $5. If she's lucky, you yeah. know, in whenever that, 1920-something.
And a lung full of felt.
And a lung full of felt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, wow.
So.
Well, I know how she feels in terms of the salary. I just don't know how she feels in terms of the lungful of felt. So,
I can't even say that fast. Lungful of felt. It's a good name for an album.
It is. next time you get a band, Lungful of Felt, I think is a good way to go. So, well, Michael, I think we should call it a halt, and we'll do it again one of these days and do part two. But
yeah, I'll tell you all about Woodstock.
that's something. I'm actually thinking about doing an occasional spin-off music podcast, because there are a lot of people that I want to talk to about music things, because that's my other life as well.
Yeah, and I know
so,
that.
We'll definitely do a Woodstock day. We'll come back and talk just about that, because I want to hear your stories. Well, thanks a lot, Michael. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my talk with Michael Mortilla nearly half as much as I enjoyed talking with him. It's always great fun for me to sit down and shoot the bull with Michael, and this was a particularly great time because, as I said before, there was a lot about his early life I did not know about. Because, after all, why should I pay any attention to anybody's life before they met me? Because without me in their lives, how important could their lives have been? But in his case, it surprisingly turned out to be quite interesting and filled with event even before he met me. So there you go. Wonders never cease. I want to, as always, thank the wonderful people who help me put this podcast on every week. My terrific and loving wife, Claire McCullough, who does the announcing at the beginning with her beautiful dulcet tones. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for my great theme music, beginning and ending music. Love it every week and get a lot of feedback from my listeners. Both of them have actually contacted me and said how much they like the music, and so I'm gratified to hear that. And thanks, too, to James Hutchins, who designed my websites, both thecommentarytrack.com and my personal website, frankthompson.tv, and I hope you'll visit both of those as often as possible. And while you're there, order stuff through Amazon, through my site. I know you're going to be ordering stuff from Amazon anyway, because everybody orders stuff from Amazon every day. We get everything we need from Amazon. I'd order milk from Amazon if I could get it, and I probably can. I just haven't looked for it. So you'd really be helping out the Commentary Track podcast if you would order things through the Amazon links, and very specifically, I put in items with specific links to all my guests. So if you're interested in learning more about the guest and reading their books or listening to their music or seeing their DVDs or whatever they're talking about, I hope you'll go through my website, either website, but thecommentarytrack.com will be just as good, and order through there, and then I'll get a little bit of a kickback, and they'll get a sale, and Amazon will get a sale, and you'll get a book or a DVD or a CD, and that makes everybody happy. That makes everybody in the world happy. And after that, if we could only teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, what a wonderful world it would be. So thanks very much, and I will keep it on the short side this time, because it's Academy Award night. And actually, the Academy Awards have been on for nearly an hour already, and what I normally do is DVR them, let them run for about an hour before I get there. That way I can zip through the commercials, and let's face it, when one of those acceptance speeches really turns out to be a snore, I can just zap through it. Sacrilege? Yeah, probably, but listen, life is for the living, right? So, anyway, thanks a lot for listening. I hope you'll join me again next week when I'll have another fascinating guest interviewed by a fascinating host. Well, I've been told. So, I'll see you then, and don't worry, we're going to fix it in post.